Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to The Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we're very honored and lucky to have on David Talbot. David is an American progressive journalist, author, and media entrepreneur. He's a founder and former CEO and editor-in-chief of one of the first web magazines, Salon.com. Since leaving Salon, Talbot has established a reputation as a historian, working on the Kennedy assassination and other areas of hidden history. And today we're going to be talking to him about his book, The Devil's Chessboard. And it really is a fascinating interview. And this is part one, and part two will be continued next week. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with David Talbot. David Talbot, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Great to be here. Thank you, Cindy.
Oh, we're very excited. When I say we, me and some of my listeners, I gave them a preview that I was going to be interviewing you, and we're very excited to have you on the show this week.
Well, I have a great respect for everything you've done, so it's great to be in conversation with you.
Well, thank you. We'll talk later about a project that you're doing that I'd like to collaborate with you on for sure. But let's get into your book, The Devil's Chessboard. It is a very fascinating read. First of all, I love spy novels. I loved reading about this. And secondly, I loathe the Dulles brothers. So it was really good to, read all of your scholarly research about this.
Well, I'm glad you began by mentioning the spy thrillers, which I, of course, love to read as well, whether John Le Carre or going back further, Eric Ambler or Graham Greene. I think those are my top three. But, I wanted to write this book in a way that was a page turner. I wanted to grip people from the very beginning. It is, I think in some ways the greatest spy epic of our time. The rise of this very, notorious character, Alan Dulles, who's been largely forgotten, I think, today. The name Dulles Airport, of course, is known to people, but that's named after his brother, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower while Dulles ran the CIA. But I wanted to bring this history to life in, I think, the most gripping way possible. So I consciously kind of adapted these sort of techniques of of spy thriller as I told the story, and so thank you for taking note of that.
And of course, a spy thriller is not complete without the women. So I do want to talk about that too, in a few more questions. But I found interesting in preparing for this interview. I watched some interviews you did about this book, or read some interviews you did about this book. And on the one you did on Democracy Now, you said that you had some interviews scheduled when it came out and that you were bumped at the last minute. And I had this experience when my book Peace Mom was published by Atria Books, a division of Simon & Schuster. And they brought me to New York. They flew me to New York, and I had I had interviews scheduled with every morning show, all the, the cable networks and things like that. And then when I got there to their offices, they said, oh, guess what? All of those were canceled. And I was already in New York. And the interesting thing is Simon & Schuster and CBS are affiliated, and they couldn't even get me on the CBS show. So talk a little bit. And Daniel Ellsberg, of course, of the Pentagon Papers, said he had the same exact experience when he published his book.
Well, absolutely. And I think, look, the people like to think that we live in this democracy where the media, of course, is open to all points of view, but it's a lie. And writers like you and I and activists again and again run up against this, particularly, I think, Cindy, on the very taboo subject of national security. There seem to be, you know, a very, I think, narrow and constricted way that the media covers these issues. And if somebody does start to break through, like you or I with a book or our activism, you know, someone gets a call at some point, a producer, an executive within one of these media companies, and they say, no, 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 you don't want this person on the air. They're trouble. And we're trouble, of course, because we're getting people to rethink the American empire, to rethink our state of permanent war, to rethink this so-called war on terror, which has been used as an excuse to rob us of our freedoms and our civil liberties and to oppress so many people around the world. And so I think, you know, the media has been very complicit with this dominant kind of Cold War at first and now war on terror policy. And they don't welcome any kind of dissent or diversity of opinion within that world. And right, same thing happened to me. I was in New York starting my tour last October for the Devil's Chessboard, which, of course, is the dark side of American intelligence. And I was scheduled to go on even Al Jazeera, for God's sake. You'd think wow. Al Jazeera would be a little more independent. I was literally in my publicist's car on the way to the studio in Manhattan to go on air, and my publicist got a email saying the interview was canceled. And when he asked why, the reply came back through email, politics. I mean, at least they were honest about
right,
it.
Right, right.
So who knows who called them or what, you know, happened there, but this is what happens all too frequently.
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, my book wasn't about yours, and Daniel's were about the exposing the, you know, the dark side. I don't know if there is a light side of this and of this intelligence, you know, apparatus here in the United States. But, you know, mine was just about exposing the pain of war and, you know, trying to get that message out to as many people as possible.
Well, so, as I might say, I think your story was hit a real nerve because so many families throughout this country have been touched by sadness and tragedy like you were. And I think they're very frightened of that message. You know, they want, you know, a constant stream of young men and women to be going to battle
right.
In these wars. And when families begin to question those policies and begin to question the sacrifice that they've been asked to make, then that's, of course, very threatening to people in power. So I could see why they would intervene in your case. And in my case, yeah, they don't want these questions to be raised about American intelligence, about American, you know, the military-industrial complex and the power it has over our democratic society.
What, yeah, so tied together, so intricately woven together. But talking about, you know, in my case, of course, they tried to demonize me, but there really wasn't anything that they can demonize a suburban mother about for a while. But then even you were a senior editor at Mother Jones, right?
I was, and then I founded Salon.
Right, and I read the interview that they did about your book, and I thought it was really smarmy, and I thought that they, I don't know the opinion you got, but they called your book they called this very important, well-researched book with so many endnotes, they called it a doorstop, and I thought the guy was trying to Aaron Weiner or Weiner, whatever his name is, he was trying to show you as some kind of crazy conspiracy theorist. How did you feel about that interview?
Well, I agree. I think it was snarky. You know, it's, believe me, it's not as bad as some of the media I've gotten from people who are even more threatened. But yeah, even left-wing publications like Mother Jones, they are very you know, concerned about not coming off as too outside the norm, you know, in terms of media. And of course, the certain subjects like the Kennedy assassination are the third rail to these people. These are timid, often timid younger journalists, even on the left, who don't want to threaten or, you know, their careers in any way or rock the boat in any way. And often they haven't done the research themselves to know, you know, some of the darker aspects of American political life or the national security world. And so they just kind of accept the conventional wisdom often. And they really are very reluctant to step outside that narrow framework. You know, I've been a journalist my entire professional career now, which is over 40 years. And I've seen this again and again. I've worked for corporate media. I've worked outside of corporate media. And I see, you know, how the pack mentality that dominates the press and the media world. And we like to think, of course, of our journalists as the brave guys like, you know, Woodward and Bernstein, which was also a lie,
right.
you know, who the great muckrakers taking on power and so forth. But the fact is, some of the most conservative and timid people I've ever met are in the media because they're very careerist. They're very, you know, afraid of giving up these soft, comfortable positions. And frankly, with the media industry, the jobs being cut back so much now and the newspaper industry in decline and so on, they're even more fearful and timid because there are not that many jobs to go around for journalists. So, you know, they're not the watchdogs that we would like them to be and that they're often mythologized to be.
Of course. And as you mentioned, they have complicity with this, the propaganda about the war on terror. Well, let's talk about, like, the rise of the Cold War. And I was born in the later 50s, so, you know, I'm a Cold War baby. And it seems that, of course, Dulles, his brother, John Foster, and Allen were the architects of the Cold War. I just recently finished a book by I.F. Stone about Korea, you know, the lies about Korea. And he wrote that, like, in 1952, right after, you know, during this whole exercise, but how they, you know, the media and the establishment has seamlessly kind of transformed from the Cold War and communism is our enemy to this war on terror and terrorism is our enemy, and how the Dulleses were the, you know, the main architects of that.
Well, absolutely. They were, as I call Alan Dulles, he was sort of Dick Cheney on steroids.
Okay.
Because of his wide sort of connections within what C. Wright Mills, the famous sociologist, called the power elite. You know, with the Dulles brothers, you see these interlocking connections between Wall Street. They ran the biggest law firm on Wall Street, Sullivan and Cromwell, from the 1920s up through the Cold War. They also, of course, were dominant figures in Washington, playing major roles there in Republican politics and administrations. And they were connected to things like the international oil industry, where many of their clients, of course, were in the major, you know, industries like oil and mining and so forth, which also connected them to power throughout the world. But really, the story is kind of, I think the book begins with the Nazi era and shows how, in many ways, the Cold War came out of World
War II.
Right. Because here you have Alan Dulles, who was our top spy during World War II in continental Europe, based in Switzerland, and he's not fighting the Nazis. He's collaborating with the Nazis for most of his time in Switzerland during the war. He's meeting secretly with high-level representatives of the Hitler regime against the policy, against the stated policy of Franklin Roosevelt, who's called for unconditional surrender, the complete crushing of the Third Reich. But Alan Dulles doesn't get the memo, so to speak. He's in defiance of FDR. He's meeting with Hitler's representatives. And what is he trying to do? He's trying to ensure that without Hitler, because he knew Hitler had to go, but without Hitler, that a large block of the Third Reich will be allowed to stay intact after World War II and continue to form a strong bulwark against the Soviet Union, which was always the Dulles brothers' main enemy, because ideologically, of course, they represent international capitalism, corporate capitalism, and the Soviet Union was their ideological foe as the bastion of communism. So they knew they could do business with Nazi Germans. In fact, they did do business with the Nazi Germans before, during, and after the war. Some of their major clients, their law firm, were notorious companies like IG Farben that produced Zyklon B, the gas that was used to murder millions of Jews in the concentration camps. And they were continuing to exchange, you know, cheery Christmas cards with the heads of IG Farben and some of the other more notorious Nazi industrialists and bankers throughout the war. So, you know, this is a history that's been suppressed. We don't like to think of some of our top people in American business and in American politics associating with these war criminals. But the fact is, Dulles not only associated with them, he protected them as the war came to an end. He made sure that many of these top Nazis were able to escape through the so-called Nazi rat lines, that these escape routes that ran over the Swiss Alps and down through Italy and then overseas. And in fact, he installed in power one of the top Nazis after the war in democratic West Germany. The top spy, the top intelligence official in West Germany was a man named Reinhard Gehlen, who was a blood-spattered chief of intelligence for Hitler on the Eastern Front during the war. And Dulles rehabilitated him and turned him into a great ally of ours during the Cold War.
Well, and this was, and that was my first question after the media question. I'm glad you are so experienced at this. It was Operation Sunshine that he was involved in?
Sunrise,
okay, that he was involved in.
Yeah, and in some ways, this is the seeds, the original sort of genesis of the Cold War. So what happens again in the final months of the war is Allen Dulles, again in defiance of FDR and his policy of unconditional surrender, it begins to negotiate with Nazi forces in Italy because he's very concerned that the Red Army, that the Russian army, which has taken the brunt of the fighting, of course, and are the real heroes of World War II, will start to come down through southern Europe, through the Balkans into Italy. And he knows that there is a strong left, a domestic left in Italy, because much of the resistance against fascism in Italy was led by, of course, the Communist Party and the left in Italy. So, you know, he's afraid of Italy going to the left after the war. So what he does is he cuts a deal with the Nazi forces, Karl Wolf, who's the head of the SS and the security forces in Italy. And under the sort of deal there that he cuts, people like Karl Wolf, who as the one of the top Nazis, really, he was the main link between Hitler and Himmler, the head of the SS, which ran, of course, the vast empire of concentration camps and the killing squads and so on, he lets him off the hook in return for really a surrender that had very little strategic value. The surrender was concluded in the final days, literally just days of the war. It didn't really save any lives. Its main purpose, as I say, was to forestall the Soviet Union's advance into Italy. And as a result, Karl Wolf and a number of other notorious war criminals who were allied with Wolf were allowed to escape justice. In the case of people like Reinhard Gehlen, you know, were even brought to this country where they were taken around to the, in Galen's case, he and his aide were taken to watch the World Series game in 1951 where the Yankees played the Giants. There they are sitting among all these New Yorkers, many of whom probably had loved ones who perished in the Holocaust in Europe.
Right.
And these two Nazis are there sitting hot dogs and watching Joe DiMaggio play against Willie Mays in that legendary World Series. So, you know, the CIA under Dulles feted these Nazis. It put them in power, and it used them in their war against the Soviet Union.
Right. So, and then the seeds of the of Cold War were sown. I was when I was reading that, it just struck me that IG Farben, their building was the only one that wasn't bombed, and that's where the I don't know what you want to call it, provisional authority or whatever, took up their offices and stuff. I was wondering if that was a coincidence that IG Farben was the only building that wasn't demolished.
No, I think it was a strategic decision that was made because they had clearly thought it would be a suitable headquarters for, as you say, the Allied military command after the war. And so you see it; these pictures are very haunting. This, palatial sort of corporate headquarters sitting among sort of this field of rubble and ruin, bombed at Berlin.
Yeah, just evil. So of course this is just an hour interview and we can't get into everything, unfortunately, that you cover, but one of the, I think a very compelling chapter was the one when you talk about how Dulles's Allen Dulles's wife and mistress were both seeing Jung, and Jung was very interested in talking to them to get to the bottom of this person, Allen Dulles. And I thought it was very compelling that the ladies got together and called him the shark. So can this was a very interesting chapter, and how did you come to include it and make it this, important part of the book?
Well, fortunately, I was able to meet and spend quite a bit of time with Joan Dulles, or Tally is her married name, who was one of Alan and Clover Dulles's daughters. And Joan, by the time I found her and connected with her, was a retired Jungian therapist herself living in Santa Fe. I feel that she wanted to get as far away from the world of Washington power as she could, that she'd grown up in. So she ended up becoming, I think, kind of a seeker of the truth, of wisdom, someone who was trying to make sense of this tumultuous life that she'd come from, this life of shadow and mystery and power. And so my conversations with Joan really opened up a lot of insights for me into Allen Dulles as her father's psychology into that world. She found him a very odd character, a very remote figure, someone who's almost like a guest in his own home. Had no real interest in his children, his two daughters and his son, his namesake Alan Jr. Even after Alan, who was a very exceptionally bright young man, Alan Jr., came back from the Korean War with a terrible head wound, and was never really the same. There was no real, feeling of compassion or understanding for what his children were going through. He would never ask them about what they were doing in school or so on. She called him a kind of a benign but remote presence in the house. I began to feel, as she talked about him, and certainly in his relations with others, even his wife Clover and his mistress. And by the way, she was the one, Joan, who gave me access to those diaries and journals of his wife and mistress. And they are a remarkable window into this man, who I do think was certainly what you would call a psychopath, someone who could, without any hint of feeling, send people to their death and even kind of take some pride in the fact that he had the power to do that. He told his mistress at one point, Mary Bancroft, who was a very interesting and bright woman in her own right, came out of the family that ran the Wall Street Journal, and she was one of his spies in wartime Switzerland. And at one point, she asked him, "How do you manage to get along with these people who are clearly your enemies?" And he said, "Well, I like to see them. They're like little mice, and I like to see them when they I lure them into traps, and then I love to watch their expression as the trap breaks their little necks." And she, of course, was appalled by this, but he didn't understand why she found that so disturbing. And he, in fact, did lure these little mice, people he knew in some cases. I write about the Noel Field family. This was a family of Quakers, of do-gooders, of people who were trying to bring peace to the world. And at one point, he lures Noel Field as part of a CIA kind of plot against Stalin during the Cold War, and then one by one, other members of Fields' family into their doom, really behind the Iron Curtain. And it's a complicated story, but it was his way of kind of help, trying to subvert Stalin in Eastern Europe. But the way he did this was to take a family who he'd known since these were children, and to sort of feed them like little mice, one by one, down the throat of the snake, Stalin. So he was capable of the most, you know, I think, terrible forms of cruelty. He put his own wife, or he attempted to put his own wife, and he did put his own son, his brain-damaged son, in the hands of the MK Ultra scientists. These were these mad scientists and doctors who, with CIA funding, were doing unspeakable mind control experiments during the Cold War. The CIA put millions and millions of dollars into these, you know, unethical experiments involving LSD and other psychedelic drugs and different forms of torture, just to see how far a human being could be programmed, or what limits they could be used. And at one point, he handed his son over to.
That's amazing to me. That's just so diabolical.
Yeah, and his son was subjected at a New York hospital to terrible insulin overdose experiments, which produce seizures and spasms, sometimes so severe that a person's spine is cracked. And Joan, who told me this story, went to see her brother in the midst of this, and he was, of course, in great pain and agony, and he begged her to try to get him out of the hospital, and she was not able to. So this was the kind of thing that Alan Dulles was capable of.
That's just amazing. Oh, like I said, very diabolical to put your own child in the hands of monsters like that. And talk more about MK Ultra.
Well, MK Ultra, of course, was you know, supposedly triggered by our fear, the U.S. fear that our soldiers overseas in the Korean War were being captured by the Chinese and subjected to these Manchurian Candidate-like mm-hmm. brainwashing experiments. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the film The Manchurian Candidate sort of is inspired by that paranoia. It turned out mm-hmm. that actually that was way overblown. And, in fact, the CIA's own scientists in the MKUltra program did a study on the so-called Chinese and Soviet mind control experimentations, and they were nothing. They were very limited compared to the vast experiments that the CIA itself was conducting. So as I say, what happened was the CIA under the MK, it was codenamed MKUltra by Dulles, they funded doctors and scientists and psychiatrists at universities and laboratories throughout the country, millions and millions of dollars throughout much of the Cold War until it was finally exposed in the 1970s by Congress. And many of these experiments, as I say, were unethical, inhumane, violated human rights law and international law, Nuremberg Code, and so on. They often took unwitting subjects, like the case at McGill University, which is one of the more notorious, under a Scottish psychiatrist named Dr. Ewan Cameron. He maintained something called the Sleep Room at McGill University, where patients, many of them women, suffering from sort of common neurotic disorders, postpartum depression or whatever, were taken by Cameron and put in the so-called sleep room, where they were put into sort of induced comas, heavily sedated, and then they were bombarded with tape loops that were meant to erase all of their previous thoughts and thought patterns, and in the process had the effect of inducing amnesia and erasing the memory banks of many of these patients, most of whom, as I said, were women. And some of the women came out of this ordeal, weeks and weeks of this, by the way, kept in this strange, like sleep, like that's why it was called the sleep room, mm-hmm. States, and didn't know who they were. Some reverted to being infants, couldn't use the bathroom. You know, didn't remember their own children afterwards and so on. It was truly hideous stuff. And again, Cameron was someone who Dulles was very close to. Dulles made sure that he got funded. He'd known him since World War II, and he used him again and again for consulting about foreign leaders and how to neutralize foreign leaders like Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. And so this was not just some, you know, kind of fringe experiment that Dulles didn't know about. He was centrally involved and aware of much of what was happening under the MKUltra name. And I think probably one of the most insidious things, if that's not insidious enough, is the efforts the CIA made under the MKUltra program to create Manchurian candidates, that is, programmed assassins who could carry out the CIA sort of death assignments, murder assignments, without even knowing what they were doing.
Right.
As the film, of course, kind of made famous. And, you know, we can talk about this later if the CIA actually was able to produce a Manchurian candidate. I think they did in Los Angeles in 1968 with Bobby Kennedy and Sirhan Sirhan, but that's a whole other story.
Okay, well, hope maybe we'll have time because I do want to talk about the Kennedy assassination and how these people were involved in it. So, of course, we have... like I said, I just got a message from Skype. It said warning, my stupid Skype. It works. It's great when it works, but when it doesn't work, it sucks. So I wrote a book recently, and I just am like grabbing things out from your book and from the interviews and things that you did. I wrote a book called Revolution, A Love Story in 2010. And it was about Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution. But, of course, I really couldn't talk about that without going back in the U.S., you know, the United States' treacherous meddling in Latin America. And for the book, I interviewed Gore Vidal, who was actually living in Guatemala when Arbenz was assassinated.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and yeah, it's a very compelling interview I did with him. I didn't know it either until I was like going there to, you know, because he's a scholar. He was an acquaintance of mine. He's a very interesting man. And I wanted to talk to him about U.S. imperialism and the Monroe Doctrine. And then he starts talking to me about living, you know, he rented an old monastery or convent in Guatemala and was there when Arbenz was overthrown. But of course, you can't tell the story of Medellin in Latin America without United Fruit and the Dulles connection and their law firm. So please talk about that. And then it will connect to Kennedy's assassination.
Sure. Well, in some ways, the Arbenz is this glamorous couple, Acaboa Arbenz and his wife Maria, who took power through election in Guatemala in the early 1950s, were the Kennedys of Guatemala, this dirt poor country, really a medieval kind of country that was controlled by a handful of land barons and by United Fruit, this huge multinational agribusiness colossus that... obviously based in the U.S. and represented by the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers law firm. And, you know, United Fruit basically controlled the economies of much of Latin America, not just the agricultural land, but often the communications infrastructure, the utilities, and so on in all of these poor countries. So they wielded enormous influence, and whenever there was any kind of labor unrest in the field or any kind of threat to their power, they were brutal in crushing it, using the local militaries and police and the CIA when necessary. And so in the case of Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954, he does begin to threaten the power of United Fruit because he, after he's elected, calls for the expropriation of unused, by the way, land that's just lying fallow but owned by United Fruit land and redistributing it to the, you know, very poor peasantry in that country. And of course this was a very popular move because he's trying to his best to alleviate poverty in the country and uplift the rural poor. And but as a result, United Fruit of course is irritated. The Dulles brothers get involved. They're now in power in Washington. They essentially run the Eisenhower presidency, you know, at least the foreign policy aspects of the presidency. Dulles Brothers convinced Eisenhower that Arbenz is a communist threat. He's a dangerous man, which is not true. He's a Democrat. He's been duly elected. And they began to undermine his presidency by creating a rebel army and beginning to create the impression, although it wasn't really true, that there's a massive invasion underway. And Arbenz decides not to fight. He decides not to stand and fight because he thinks there'll be a bloodbath.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he does under enormous pressure from his own military and from the United States is to step down, give up his power peacefully. A young Che Guevara, so not just Gore Vidal happens to be in Guatemala during this eventful time, mm-hmm. but a young Che Guevara is there. He watches this, and he actually goes to Arbenz's people and says, arm the peasants. Arm the people and let us resist, and he's ready to help lead it. But Arbenz decides not to faithfully, and of course the result is he's pushed out of power. He goes into exile, and it's a terrible exile because the CIA literally stalks him all around the world. No place really will accept him, no country. He, you know, when he does finally is allowed to come to a country, they strip him of all his rights. They say he can't speak. He has to become a non-person. And finally, in desperation, he ends up for a while in Cuba, but he's not happy there because of the restrictions on his freedom there as well. And he ends up back in Mexico in exile. And he's found dead in a scalding hot bathtub one night in Mexico City. It was called somehow a suicide, although I don't think many people get into a scalding hot bathtub to kill themselves.
Right.
But his family, of course, thinks to this day that he was murdered by the CIA. I think there's a very good chance of that because we now know from other documents that have been released that the CIA did indeed have a death list related to Guatemala and the coup. They wanted to get rid of not just Arbenz and his family, but they wanted to get rid of union leaders and journalists and anyone who was a threat to the military dictatorship that took over Guatemala and proceeded, of course, to turn it into one of the worst killing, most hideous killing fields of the 20th century. Death squads roaming the countryside, rounding up peasants and activists and union leaders and murdering them. So there's a very good chance that Jacobo Arbenz was indeed one of the victims of this CIA killing machine that I don't think has gotten its full due for how lethal it's been mm-hmm. around the world. We know about the few leaders that supposedly they targeted because of the Church Committee hearings in Congress in the 70s, that they tried to kill Castro and Patrice Lumumba in the Congo and Diem in Vietnam. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. I think what American people don't realize is the CIA-funded killing machine also targeted people under the radar, so-called union leaders and so on, journalists, dissidents, and many of them were indeed killed. And I think Arbenz might very well be one of the victims of the CIA killing machine.
And that was right also at this in the same time frame that Mossadegh in Iran was deposed. And from what I read, you know, not from your book, but that was like with Kermit Roosevelt, right?
That's right.
Yeah, it was like one of the very first times that they felt maybe...
The nephew of Teddy.
Right. A targeted removal would be better than all-out war. And so that was one of the templates, I guess, for their future misadventures.
That's right. That was their first major victory. The CIA's overthrowing a democratically elected government, Prime Minister Mossadegh, who was a very popular figure because he was, for the first time, standing up against the imperial control of his country and its resources. Its oil was virtually controlled entirely by the company that's now British Petroleum
mm-hmm.
and by American oil companies. And when he begins to challenge that Western control of his nation's resources by nationalizing the local oil industry, of course, all hell breaks loose. And British intelligence and the CIA collaborate to overthrow Mossadegh, which they do and he spends the rest of his life under house arrest, while the Shah, of course, is reinstalled as a dictator, and we all know how that went, that movie went. Of course, the America is still paying the price for its arrogance there, and, you know, the kind of deep feelings of resentment and fury that people of Iran have against the U.S. are quite valid when you understand this history, which Bernie Sanders, to his credit, briefly alluded to during one of his debates. And of course, the American media went, huh? And, you know, kind of made fun of him for digging up this old history. Well, it's not old history. As William Faulkner said, there's nothing past about the past. We're continued to be haunted by our history. And in fact, Americans have this terrible amnesia about their history, which makes it even worse because we're never then in the position of learning from our history.
We just as an aside, my sister and I were watching Mysteries at the Museum yesterday, and my some of my children were over too, and they were talking about how during the takeover of the embassy in Iran and you know, that uprising, how, and they made a movie about it. I forget what the movie was called.
Argo.
Yeah, and so.
Which was basically a CIA fairy tale.
Absolutely. And so how this brave man got these embassy employees out of Iran, and the narrator says, and they were afraid that they would be seen as CIA employees. And I just looked at my sister. I said, they probably were. You know, isn't that how the CIA, how embassies and the CIA operate in other countries most of the time?
That's right. The CIA often operates under diplomatic cover through American embassies. And you know, anyone who's not a child understands this, particularly in these countries where America is doing all its mischief. Look, Argo, by the way, is, you know, the great Hollywood liberal Ben Affleck. That was the film that he made,
right,
and won the Academy Award for. It's a complete piece of CIA mythology. Again, Hollywood does this. Zero Dark Thirty.
I was about to
outrage.
Mention Zero Dark Thirty.
Here's a movie that romanticizes or mythologizes CIA torture. A movie like American Sniper, romanticizing a psychopath who was murdered, dozens and dozens of Iranian people. Maybe some of them were militants.
Iraqi, rather.
Yeah. Thank you. And maybe they weren't. We'll never know. It was, you know, execution. So the CIA, in fact, operates a very big office in Hollywood because they know how important Hollywood is as a source of propaganda. And they learned their mistake from not keeping an eye on Hollywood, apparently, after Oliver Stone released his explosive film, JFK, back in 1991, which, of course, pointed towards the CIA as the chief culprit in the assassination of the president. So they weren't going to let that happen again. So what they did was set up a major operation there. And now often you see on these programs, any program having to do with espionage or spies, whether it's Homeland or 24 or all those, often have an ex-CIA person involved as a consultant who's overseeing the show. And, you know, you really can't do a spy show without that kind of approval. Just like you can't get approval from the Pentagon to use, you know, war equipment or things like that unless your script has been pre-approved by the Pentagon. So the national security state has a, you know, firm control over Hollywood and what comes out of there. I found this out similar to how you and I have been blocked by the American media. My book Brothers, which was on the Kennedy presidency and the assassination of President Kennedy, was optioned by Lionsgate, which is a major Hollywood studio. This is a few years ago. They were all set to set it up as a TV series. John Hamm at one point from Mad Men was set to play JFK. They had, you know, top screenwriters and producers lined up, and we thought we had a deal at one network after the next, but someone got a call or made a call, and suddenly the deals we thought we had disappeared overnight, literally. I'm finding this out, I think, yet again with the Devil's Chessboard, great interest involved in it by Hollywood, everyone set to go, and then suddenly it evaporates. So I think the CIA still plays a very powerful and pernicious role when it comes to the entertainment industry, not just the news media.
Stay tuned for next week for part two, and I'm sorry for the abrupt ending, but I was experiencing some technical difficulties. Well, that's the soapbox for this week. I hope it fascinated you as it fascinated me. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank David for giving us his time and for being so flexible and kind with the difficulties we had this week. And we will be back, like I said, next week with part two of this very fascinating interview. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.